I should mention that although I'm a cathedral archaeologist and there hasn't been much archaeology there for many years, but if I can promote something that has appeared now, it's the new guidebook for Llandaff Cathedral, written by my former colleague John Kenyon, who is librarian at the National Museum. And so that has only just appeared, and it is a very nicely produced guide to the cathedral. So I'd like to express my thanks for the invitation on behalf of my co-editors for the book, and what I'll try and do is just give you a sort of potboiler sampler of something that, should you be inclined to look further at the book, borrow it from the library or whatever, it gives you a sense of the diversity of Welsh involvement with the sea over the centuries. And thank you for holding this lecture in this wonderful building and with this wonderful society, amazing surroundings. I'd like to start with this charming watercolour that shows two Welsh women in traditional dress, 19th century, and it actually dates from between 4th of December 1837 and 16th of January 1838. Now we know that because the ship in the background is the paddle steamer Amazon, moored at Holyhead at the time. Amazon was the first steam vessel to be employed by the Admiralty Hydrographic Department. Firstly, she was used for survey work off the west coast of Africa and then around Lisbon and Porto. But finally, she was working quite heavily in the St George's Channel and the Irish Sea in the areas around Holyhead. And it really just sets the scene. I must thank Tom Lloyd, Welsh Herald Extraordinary, who has this, has allowed us to copy this wonderful find of his. Right. Oh, hang on. Right, okay. Is this the one? Just need to work out how to move on the clicker. So I might just pause for a technical. Do we know how we do this?
Can you press the button at the bottom here? Because that's the next.
Oh, it's down there, is it? Right, okay. Right. Bingo. Some of you may recognise Derek Walcott's Nobel Laureate poetry, his powerful poem, The Sea is History, which he wrote in and published in 1980. His perspective was one from the centuries Caribbean, but I think what he says here is relevant as much to almost any country with a coastline, and particularly in this context tonight, to the Welsh experience of living by the sea and the legacy that history creates. Wales has always been a seafaring and sea-dependent nation, although perhaps history tends to focus on some of the terrestrial aspects of what happened these days. So we wanted to remedy that with the diversity of the book. We wanted to look at the inspiration from the cultural perspective, creativity, poetry, literature, and so on. We want to look at the archaeology, we want to look, of course, at the history, and perhaps broaden horizons a little, different ways of thinking about the sea. Welsh seas actually cover 15,000 square kilometres and make up 43% of the area of Wales, if you include both land and sea. So that immediately puts it into perspective. And traditionally, it's long indented 750-mile coastline, I may be corrected on that, holds a wealth of castles, seaside resorts and industrial ports, which we mention in the book. But of course, it's got its own share of legends, many of which you won't need here reminding of. This is Borth, of course, exposed in the spring of 2010, where 630 tree stumps from prehistory were exposed after stormy weather. But it puts immediately into context one of the sources for the famous Welsh legend mentioned, the Black Book of Carmarthen, written before or about 1250, concerning the drowned Cantre Gwaelod on the Lowland Hundred beneath the Irish Sea in Cardigan Bay. And this is precisely the sort of archaeology that will provide that acorn from which some of these legends are going to grow. This is tidal exposure. Periodically, these are covered up again. amazing research potential there. Until about the 17th century, the land was called Maes Gwyddnog, the land of Gwyddnog, but best known today as Cantre Gwaelod, once part of the 6th century kingdom of the mythical ruler Gwyddnog, Garanhir, or Longshanked. But that's not the only legend we've got in Wales. We've got many more from the early medieval period that have a maritime connection. So just think of Nennius, author of Historia Britonum, however you define it, and the Wonders of Brittany, describing the Severn Boar. He mentions the fabled Mathen plank, a piece of timber that served as a step in front of a sacred spring near Mathen Church. Quote, "Men may wash their hands and their faces and have a plank under their feet when they wash. Each time this was swept away to sea in a Severn flood, and each time that happened, it was returned exactly to the same place from which it had been carried." Sea stepping in there. References to the sea abound in the Mabinogion. Some may reflect perceptions and memories of 13th and 14th centuries, but the time when they were set down on parchment. But others may unconsciously reflect earlier mythologies, ideologies, and perspectives. All but 8 of the 79 place names in the Four Branches are in Wales, and many of them are coastal. So there again, the sea plays an important role. This will be familiar to many of you. Misericord in St. David's, which is one of two showing a ship. Fortunately, one of the passengers looks rather ill. That illustrates, just as the medieval wordsmith, the court poets, reflected real hopes, fears, and aspirations for their audiences, poetry did as well. So a poem, which you refer to, Iologos' masterpiece, one of them, reflects in vivid terms the discomfort experienced by many on board such merchant vessels. And if you've been in a small sailing ship, it's not a pleasant experience. And many of the medieval ships were quite short. High-nosed hag, scabby-edged board with hollow nostril, rope-reined saddle, breadth of kneading trough, shape of a new moon. Perhaps I should have recited the Welsh. But wonderfully expressive, and you can see from his poetic wordsmithry how he's derived those particular descriptions. So medieval ships were half moon-shaped by and large. Then we've heard already of wine and imports. The Newport ship was heavily involved with importing all sorts of materials. It had cork on board, as well as barrel staves for wine. We know of 15th century poets praising Welsh gentry. Wine from Bayonne, Normandy, Bordeaux, La Rochelle, Speyer and Rhine, a bit further over, and Spain. In the elegy to Meredith ap Cymmerig, Rhys Goch Eryri described a ship laden with Spanish wine on its way to replenish Meredith's Anglesey cellar, and comments on Meredith's good taste and high social standing as much as anything else. We're lucky in the National Museum to have a copy of Gesner's Orbis Terrarum. And what's wonderful about this is it reflects the spheres of mariners in the medieval world. It's not directly relevant to Wales, except that Welsh seamen would have been involved in whaling at some point in time, in Newfoundland, whatever. But you can see how, for example, here they're trying to discourage the whales from attacking the ship by lobbing barrels of Newport ship type overboard. So keep off. And of course, fish were terribly important. Anglesey was famous in the Middle Ages for its fish, so were other parts of Wales. This is the 13th century seal of Anon, rural dean of Llyn in Gwynedd, found in 1890 near Cricieth. And it's got a fish as his emblem. Feel like. Looks a bit like a pike, so it could be a freshwater fish, but we don't know. We've got a wealth of documentary sources, some better known than others, providing a historical perspective on medieval shipping in Wales and the risks taken by those engaged with the sea. To give one example only, there was a voyage on or about the 19th of January in 1309 during cold weather on the coast of the parish of Abergele. Storms forced an unnamed ship to seek the safety of Vorid Creek, or the mouth of the Cluid at Vorid. It was first, the ship was forced to beach on the west side of the estuary at Cloud's Mouth, or Cluid Mouth, within the lordship of the Castle of Denby, while the crew tried to save the cargo. They managed to unload 4 tons of barrels and 2 pipes, smaller barrels, of red wine and casks, as well as salted red herring, before the crippled ship was carried helplessly out to the rough sea by the wind and the rising flood tide. 3 sailors were left ashore, but the rest perished when the battered ship was driven aground on the opposite side of the estuary upon the sands of the Lord King at Birchloit, near Rotherland or Rhythlin. So we've got a fairly full account of that particular loss, tragic loss of life. It was customary in those circumstances for a watch to be organised by the county sheriff, Richard de la Lee, but the inhabitants of Rhythlin, surprise, surprise, took custody of many of the items cast ashore, and pilfering of the ship's equipment couldn't be prevented. Many of the planks and timbers and much equipment were retrieved along the foreshore, and most of the timbers ended up in domestic hulls in Rhythlin. Ropes, anchors, hatches and other tackle were noted in subsequent inquisition, much of it, inverted commas, removed by persons unknown. Well, the herrings had by then been cooked and eaten and the wine consumed. So they had a jolly party. Even the coroner of Englefield, Bleddyn Crach, or Scabby, despite being responsible for recording and assessing the wreck, misused his authority to claim an anchor and rope. So all sorts of shenanigans going on, the Haverford West Seal being a very important example of a representation of the commerce engaged by coastal towns. We're looking at the moment on the left at a flood chapbook illustrating the 1607 storm surge that Mark Lewis recently reassessed in Monmouth Antiquary. There were various thoughts that perhaps, Camden mentions this in Britannia, the great Severn estuary flood or inundation. It wasn't an idea for a short period that could it have been a tsunami, but I think it's generally accepted that it's a storm surge. And of course it's quite topical these days, when even this morning we were hearing of sort of more concern about the estimated rate of sea level rise over the next 50, 100 years. So some of the issues that occurred are going to recur, some of the challenges are still with us. E.G. Bowen, many years ago, drew attention to Britain and the Western Seaways and the importance of the sea in the age, what he called the Age of Saints, in the historic period. He used the term sea in the fabric of settlement. I think that's a very useful phrase to have, because it puts maritime transport bang in the centre of population movements, commerce and so on. And Donald Moore, of course, you may remember, edited an important collection of papers on the Irish Sea province, while the late George Boone, inter alia, excavated in the 60s on the Roman quay at Caerleon. And also published a Roman anchor stock at Porthmellon, as well as publishing imported Roman barrels from Saguntum. So in the Roman period, we've got solid archaeological evidence for trade and commerce. Much of the new research that Mark Lewis and others are undertaking are underpinning all of that, of course, with new data. On the screen, you can see some imports from the Byzantine world in the early medieval period from Dinas Poeis. We know there was significant indirect contact through long-distance networks of trade, through travel and diplomatic exchange in the post-Roman world. And there are much debated literary sources suggesting a range of connections between early medieval Britain and the Mediterranean, from networks of trade, pilgrimage, activities of clerics and diplomatic initiatives. So one of the questions is, what is the scope and scale, or changing scale, of these exchanges? And archaeology is providing one perspective on that through the imports such as these red wares, Phocaean red slipwares, North African slipwares that are coming in from the Mediterranean. Because we know that seagoing ships from Spain, North Africa, and the Aegean brought goods, wine and oil and associated wares to the southwest England and Wales in return for copper, lead, tin and homegrown commodities. And we've got a fairly good idea of the distribution of the late 5th and 6th century pottery from the Mediterranean reaching Britain, with a centre of gravity focused on South Wales and the southwest of England, perhaps the largest collection being at Tintagel, of course. So, suggesting a region of Britain where either direct or indirect contact was maintained by sea between the Byzantine East Mediterranean and post-Roman British kingdoms for a period, peaking around 475 to 550. It's been suggested that much of the modest quantity of Byzantine pottery reaching Ireland, so I'm sorry my boat's got stuck in Gibraltar, but this is just a bit of fun for a conference some time ago. I thought it would be nice to bring it round again. So the big question is it direct trade or is it indirect trade down the line? And to what extent does the Welsh material, indeed the Irish material, arrive having been redistributed from southwest of England, for example? I think the court is out on that. But, we can certainly envisage silver, slaves and food being exchanging hands, and wine being imported, of course, with other commodities as well. So we're just saying, yes, right. So on to a smaller form of less seaworthy craft, but no less important. Following the discovery of this log boat in Clangors Lake in 1922, and I know it's a freshwater context, but it is quite important because some of the log boats in Wales are close to the coast. Some of them are in rivers that had access to the coast. So he undertook, Warnell, keeper of archaeology at the National Museum, before he became director, a rigorous study of the details of such craft. He became rather interested in what he called monoxylus craft in Britain. And he drafted and published a seminal paper on these as a consequence of largely this discovery provoking his interest. Sean McGrath then re-examined all these logboats in the 1970s, and he was able for the first time to produce a radiocarbon date, working with Roy Switzer, which was terribly important and established that this boat was in fact not Roman, as Fox believed at the time, but early medieval, with a central radiocarbon date around 814 AD. Which is quite close to the date of the Cranon that we ended up excavating in the late 1980s and 90s. So I'm sure that if we all think back to our childhood, we probably come up with numerous motivations for why we'd be more or less interested in the sea. It's certainly inspired antiquaries and archaeologists. I was inspired by Tintin. And ended up, that's me, on the Catwater Wreck in Plymouth Harbour, the first bit of maritime I got involved in. Sadly, it's Jules Verne, so that's the romance of it, of course. When we were working on the Catwater, which incidentally was the first site, wreck site, to be scheduled under the new Protection of Wrecks Act in 1973, which is over 40 years ago, but then marine archaeology was in its infancy. We had few models of guidelines to follow. We more or less made it up as we went along. And we were looking at other projects as well to see how they did it. But that was fascinating. We ended up excavating an early 16th century merchantman in Plymouth Sound, in the Catwater, the last reach of the river, which had swivel guns and a mixed shot on board. Again, that's resonant of what the evidence that's now coming from the Newport ship. The Protection of Wrecks Act came into force largely as a response to the furore over the uncontrolled diving and looting of this site here, the Royal Yacht Mary, lost off the Skerries and Anglesey in 1675. This was actually a press cutting I glued into this scrapbook while I was still at school. And little did I know then I'd find a use for it. But it was a rather controversial salvage operation looting operation back in the 70s. And as a consequence of that, because the material, the rich material from this site wasn't being properly recorded or rescued, the legislation came in. We know quite a bit about there you see the Royal Yacht Mary. There's a Van der Velde sketch as well. I think this is Van der Velde as well. Before it was given as a gift to Charles II when he became king. We know its dimensions, 66 foot long. Being Dutch, it was shallow drafted and it had fan shaped knee boards on either side. And it's an early yacht, so this is the start of the fad for yachts and for racing. It was designed for speed, but it was designed for Dutch waters, which are somewhat different from the Atlantic, of course. It had two foresails, a long bowsprit, and a brass unicorn figurehead. It had lanterns, gilt lanterns, in the stern, and rich carving, including the royal coat of arms. And on the deck, there was a gilded pavilion for the royal passengers. It was a glittering yacht, carved, polished. It had bronze guns, it had flags, and two red, white, and blue pennants. An amazing sight for eyewitnesses when it was sailing up and down the Thames. But then eventually she lost favour with its royal owner by about 1665, possibly because of its lack of speed. It wasn't fast enough. And that's partly because a lot of the English waters are deeper and rougher around Britain than home waters in Holland. So it was refurbished for general service and provided transport for the Lord Lieutenant of Dublin and his officials for safe passage for precious cargo between Chester and Dublin. And it was on one such journey that it met its end in poor visibility, coming to grief on the jagged rocks on the Skerries just on the north side of Anglesey. The captain, 35 passengers and 3 crew were drowned, but the remaining 15 passengers and 24 crew survived. They spent a very uncomfortable night on the rocky island before they were rescued by a vessel dispatched the next day from Beaumaris. The site was initially, as I've said, salvaged when found by divers in the 70s, but later excavated, once protected, under license by archaeologists led by Merseyside Maritime Museum. A detailed report has been published by Matthew Tanner. And you can see some of the objects here. So. There are many more illustrated in the along the book. Over the years, there have been significant advances and great progress in protecting maritime archaeology underwater, especially in the 80s and 90s, in identifying and designating sites. The late Richard Avon, Chief Inspector of Ancient Monuments in Kelly, was very supportive of this initiative, as were our Inspector Sharon Riesel, who's retired now, and the late Luke Turner, who was very active as well, and George Boone in our museum, who was a stalwart member of the Advisory Committee on Historic Wreck Sites, advising scheduling of sites under the protection of wreck sites for many years. This is the Louisa, built in Nova Scotia in the mid-19th century. She's been protected under the Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act of 1979, which allows the protection of ancient monuments within territorial waters. So it doesn't. The advantage, of course, it doesn't have to be a wreck. It can protect a submerged settlement site under this Act. The protection of wreck site only deals with wrecks. And this is a view of her before the embayment with the Kirkcaldy Barrage. We were able to recommend to Kerry that the site was protected, and that's an initiative that Sean took up. We're very glad now that although you can't see her, there was a recording exercise, she actually uses iron knees. You can just see some. Just there, you can see these here. And on the other side, it was the beginnings of experimenting with the transition from timber to use of iron on board ships. So Seppings introduced diagonal bracing using iron. But iron knees were actually introduced about this period in the mid-19th century as well. Another interesting bit of scheduling that Sharon was responsible for is this wonderful beacon or lighthouse at Whitford Point in Glamorgan. Of course, the responsibility for designation and regulation in Welsh waters is now with CADW. And in the past, they funded the Nautical Archaeology Society to provide training for divers and others on archaeological survey and excavation techniques and on educational and outreach opportunities. The Welsh Archaeological Trusts have played their part as well, embarking on programmes of community involvement aimed at training volunteers and local groups to assist in hard survey around the coast. And that has been extremely valuable in pointing out endangered coastal sites on estuaries, rocky headlands, beaches and cliff tops. I'd like to mention other champions of underwater archaeology in Wales, such as Cecil Jones, who excavated the Porthfannog Slate Wreck and the Menai Strait, Mike Bowyer, John Ilsley and Owen Roberts, responsible for excavating and lifting the 18th century Llyn Padarn and Llyn Perris boats. So we've got the 18th century Llyn Padarn slate carrying boat here, which is at Llanberis, of course, at National Slate Museum on display. And the one on the top is the Llyn Perris Elizabethan boat, which I'm pleased to say was on display with First Hydro. They donated it to the National Museum, and we're looking at ways in which we might actually eventually get it back on display. But she is the most complete Elizabethan boat in the whole of Great Britain. It's not very often you could go along and say, that is Elizabethan. They don't do this in this way. I mentioned Llangors. So some sites have been found by sport divers by accident. Some sites have been found by strand loping and walking along the shoreline, discovering stuff after stripping, the storms have stripped the beaches of sand and so on. This is an interesting method of discovery. We were excavating at Llangors, and one of our supervisors, Steve Waring, who went on to work for English Heritage, decided he wanted to get a Mars bar for his lunch. And instead of getting in the inflatable and taking the boat over to the shore, he said, "Oh, don't worry, I'll just wade across in my suit." And so he waded across and tripped over the logboat. So it was amazing. And it was actually fragmented. Where we've got a feeling it might have been observed by the Dumbletons when they were working on the Crown Hog in the 1860s. But it's another remarkable find. It's later than the first logboat to be found, because we know this is late 12th, early 13th century from the radiocarbon dates. So ours, the second logboat, is on the top from Llangors. This one is from Llandrindod Wells, found in the river. Savory helped to recover. And just to show you that logboats are fascinating, this is a contemporary photograph of the locals just enjoying the discovery and the mystery of its age, because the point of discovery, radiocarbon dating didn't exist. So most of these were assigned to either the Roman period or prehistory, prehistoric dugouts. But now, of course, with Switzer's work, you've got the radiocarbon dates down there, we can rectify that in terms of facts. Of course, the fun doesn't stop there, because when we were at Llangors, we had Time Team in 94. They wanted to do something exciting, so we said, why don't you recreate the logboat based on the first logboat, which is approximately contemporary with the early medieval Cranmer. And they agreed to do that, and I said, well, the best person to do that is David Goodburn, a good friend who's in London, works for the Museum of London Archaeological Services, and an expert in carpentry. So he worked on it. Of course, being Time Team, they only had 3 days, so the chainsaw had to speed up the process. But it was launched, and interestingly, Nigel Jervis looked after it subsequently. He lives at Timau on the south side of the lake. So I said to Nigel, can you look after it? Just keep it submerged and it should be all right. He actually got married in it, because he rang up and he said, "Mark, would you mind? We're getting married. my wife and I in Tobian and in Timau Church. But after we come out of the church, we'd like to get into the log boat and paddle over back to the house for the reception. I said, oh, that's really good, yes. By all means, you know. Well, no, what's interesting about this, this is 25 years later. So I still rang Nigel when we were getting Plank Walls ready for publication. I said, I'm afraid there's something we forgot to do. We forgot to measure speed trials when it was launched at 90. You've still got the logboat, haven't you? He said, yes, yes. I said, is there any chance of getting it out of the water so we can just check it out and then see if it still floats? So he got it out of the water. I spent a day and a half stopping up the cracks with wax and sheep's wool. We made it watertight. This is, you know, it's a generation old. It still works. And we managed to work out that, you know, basically it's like paddling a wash basin. There's no keel, so you've got no control and direction. Punting is actually faster, and you can use the punt as a rudder. But we didn't have a punting pole, so we had to paddle. But these strapping lads who were volunteering in the area said, oh, we'll have a go as well. So it's incremental to age. So I was the oldest who had a go, and I did 3.5 knots. Nigel, who's 10 years younger than me, managed to do 4 knots, 4.5, and these could do 5 knots. So only a short burst, but you can just see that more or less accords with the estimates based on the shape and so on of other examples. Another find, a rather remarkable find, was made at Magor Pill by the late Derek Upton back in 1994, who was then warden of the nature reserve there, and he knew the foreshore at low tide like the back of his hand. He rang me up and he invited a group of us, including Nigel Mailing and David Turner as well, to come over to look at what he believed might be ship timbers in the intertidal muds at Magor Pill. So we went to have a look, and all we saw were the very top frames of some timbers. This timber was sticking out, and there were a few others, but not much. So I bet Nigel a pint of beer that we were actually looking at a medieval ship. Eventually, because of the Second Severn Crossing was happening, they actually sponsored the lifting and recording of the excavation, also by Cadu, through GIGAT. This ship was lifted. The dendrochronological date established that it was felled in 1240 AD, so in the 13th century. Which is, of course, the year of Joachim Faraday's death. It was lifted in a cradle. Huge interest in the lift, a bit like the Mary Rose. They were following it in Japan or on the other side of the world. And we were able in the museum to slowly dismantle it in its cradle, in a tank. And everything's now conserved. All the timbers are in store at our collection centre at Nangavum. But it's remarkable, 13th century, it's the most complete 13th century boat in Britain. And it had 171 kilos of its cargo still on board, iron ore, resting on a wooden hurdle, which was quite well preserved. So Tim Young did some scientific analysis of the ore and could identify it to the Llanharry Forest Burrow area. The big question then is, right, well, if it's been moved as ore, but what was it going to be turned into? Ploughshares or swords? We don't know. But a very interesting and important find. So this is some of the ore, different grades of ore. This is powdery ore, and you've got lump ore as well. So we estimated that the medieval capacity for a cargo of a ship like this was about 3/4 of a ton, quite a small craft. It was about 13 metres long. The recording took place in Cardiff, and we eventually made a one-to-one model. We got Gifford and partners to make a pine model of each timber to give us a sense of its original form, using the original fastening holes for each plank. Of course, now with the Newport ship, because they've been digitally recording all the timbers, they can digitally print all their timbers to scale at 1 to 10. with far more accuracy than we did with acetate tracings at 1:1 here. Of course, they've created a marvellous model of the Newport ship, what's preserved, and they can extend the lines of the ship upwards to the upper decks and so on. So this was we used the available methods of the period back in the 90s to do that. But it has had other applications. So Chris Jones Jenkins was commissioned to create a new reconstruction of the harbour at Beaumaris Castle. And so he took the nautical information we provided him with to create this digital model, which he can rotate and play around with perspective on. And this then became a basis for one of his new reconstructions, which is part of the new Cadu guidebook for Beaumaris. Wonderful finds, isolated finds, if only we knew more about their original context. This is a find made around 1830 of a very rare example of early ordnance, as a medieval cannon gun, still attached to its open bed. And it was discovered during dredging in Tenby Bay, according to reports about 300 metres northeast of Sker Rock, a formation not far from St Catherine's Island and Castle Beach. Somewhere in that vicinity, there's this wonderful medieval wreck under the sand. We know, although some people speculated that this was a Mary Rose Dean Brothers gun that had been collected, because it was on display at Pembroke Castle for one period. The dimensions are a little smaller than the Mary Rose guns. But we were able, Tony and I went up to Tenby Museum and recorded it, and that's our new reconstruction of the gun based on contemporary evidence from other sites. So we know it's not a Mary Rose port piece, but that's the sort of gun it is, and reflects on board the need even on merchantmen as well as kingships for defensive guns of this type. So other defensive guns have been found around Wales. The hackbutt, early form of arquebus or handgun, has on the top is late medieval. It's got a recoil stop so you can hook it over a parapet on a ship or a crenellation on a castle wall to stop the recoil when it fires. It's made cast in bronze, but the wooden tiller stock, which would have extended that way, is still, at the end of it, what's left of it, is still stuck in the socket at the end, wedged in with a piece of medieval textile. That was found at Bardsey Island by divers. And at the time, one of the divers said it was on a pile of them. So we know roughly where it's from. There have been attempts to inspect the site, but the kelp cover is quite overgrown. So not much. It's very hard to spot anything. But I wonder, we've got another medieval wreck, late medieval or early 16th century, on Bardsey Island, just begging for discovery. You know, what stories will it tell when it is found? We've also been looking at coastlines. So coastal finds on beaches can be very informative. So this is a distribution of objects reported through the Port of Antiquities scheme in Wales, which we host in the museum. We've added just by period the different colours represented. But interestingly, there is a little cluster of pilgrim badges, these blue ones here, in this sort of area. I mean, Swans is up here. And other beaches have produced pilgrim badges as well. So you're thinking of, if you go down to Pembrokeshire, White Sands and Newgale, have both produced rather interesting pilgrim badges. And pilgrimage relied heavily on sea transport. These voyages were often in the early summer, returning if possible before the autumn storms. But you can imagine travellers like the ones on the Misericord in St Davis embarking on such long journeys, needing something to comfort them. You know, they would no doubt consider the possibility of death on the voyage and invoke heavenly help. And so pilgrim badges were often a cultural component of daily life in a sense. Not only did the Ampulli with the phials of Jordan water offer sort of remedies for illness and sickness, but you could buy a badge of Thomas Becket. We've got quite a few from Wales now. If you went to Canterbury, we've got examples of Becket badges from Newgale, Tenby and Swansea Bay. So perhaps some of these were actually jettisoned into the sea as thanks offerings by relieved passengers on reaching land and getting out of the boat after their voyage. Again, we don't know. Sometimes the evidence is not directly related to whales, but it's in the Cardiff Library, this wonderful marginal sketch by someone who's rather bored with the religious tract that he was scribbling in. But it's a wonderful evocation of a Tudor ship. And if you look closely, you've got men in the rigging, crow's nests, flag, you've got, is that a white rose boar, I don't know. But you've got details here at Stirling Castle reminiscent of the Mary Rose. And if you look closely, that is the barrel of a gun with its wheel. There's another barrel of a gun and its wheel. So lots of, and this rather interesting depiction of the packing on the ship as well. So really interesting. The whole thing is only about this big. And then, you know, you get different levels of detail. So this is in the same book, and it looks a bit like a pilgrim badge rather than a ship. But these doodles have their own stories to tell. But sometimes we do have solid evidence emerging from the sands of an archaeological site, and we're getting closer to some of them. The Americans use the term the mother lode for the core deposit. Normally, they're looking for treasure. I don't think we've got the mother lode for these ships yet. We'd dearly like to find some of the surviving ship structure. But we know the name of this one. These navigational dividers were acquired by the museum in the 70s and 80s by metal detectorists working on Aberavon Beach, Marlon Beach. Other finds were recorded, including lead sounding weights for plumbing the depths and working out depth of water beneath the ship, and various coins. And we know that these come from the wreck of the Anne Frances, wrecked in the winter of 1583. And fortunately, there's a contemporary record of what was recovered at the time from the beach. And if we add to that list what we have recorded archaeologically coming in over the last 20 or 30 years, we're building up a picture of, if you like, an inventory of what's on board a ship of the Elizabethan period. So here are some of the finds. So we've got a large number of coins, Spanish and Spanish, American, Portuguese and German coins. The Spanish coins are all Ferdinand and Isabella, probably struck after their deaths. The Mexican coins were produced from 1554. And these are all silver coins. They support the 16th century inventory record of £12, 6 shillings and no pence of Spanish silver being recovered from the beach at the time. The Portuguese coins are from the reign of John III, who died in 1557. And there's a gold San Vicente in our collections from 1555 to 58. And these German coins on the bottom are all German states minted in the 1540s and between 1540 and 1556. So that gives us a sense of bullion probably locked up in a Spanish vault, because we know the owner of the ship was engaged in trading with the Iberian Peninsula and with Spain. Spain was suffering a famine in the 1580s, and a lot of East Anglian grain, because the owner was from East Anglia, from Kingsley, was being exported to Spain. Interestingly, this is only 5 years before the Armada set sail. And Shackson was known as one of the greatest pirates of the time in terms of illicit trade. But it's a fascinating reflection of what's going on. And we've been looking at new finds coming in, many, many new finds. There was a bosun's pipe up there. There was a silver bosun's pipe recorded in the Star Chamber accounts in the 1580s. That padlock is a recent find. It's often called a Nuremberg type padlock. It's a combination lock, and it still revolves. And I haven't worked out the combination yet. It's really interesting. The problem is, the sand's got inside, so you're looking, if you try and listen to clicks, all you hear is this sort of grating noise. Sometimes words were a clue, but we've tried various formulae and they don't work, so it's just a matter of keeping on trying. One of the interesting backgrounds for this story is that this is the Earl of Pembroke. He was involved. Once the ship had struck, there was a confrontation on the beach. with about 100 people there, all trying to salvage stuff. Sundry outrageous misdemeanours, to use the official terminology, were committed, and according to Star Chamber proceedings, much wreckage was spirited away in the 3 or 4 hours before George Williams, who was an agent of Lord Pembroke, and Anthony Mansell from the Penrice, Oxford and Margam estate, could muster escorts to exert law and order. The two of them were arguing over ownership because it depended on which side of the River Avon the wreckage had been deposited. Interestingly, Henry Herbert, 2nd Earl of Pembroke, courtier, one of the richest men in Wales, was Admiral of South Wales from 1586, and he was responsible for, amongst other things, dealing with pirates and their prizes and salvage claims from wrecked ships. So the great thing is we've got this wonderful account, we've got some of the protagonists involved, represented, we've got the portraits, but we've got the material culture from an archaeological perspective, because we know the date of the wreck. It's a time capsule of cultural material from that date. That was material circulating in 1583. So when we find another example on an archaeological site that can't be dated from its context, we can recite this evidence for date. So that's really important. Many of you may have grown up knowing about the dollar wreck and its legendary status in Prosody Bay. And that legend arose partly because of the newspaper accounts in the early 19th century. The Cambrian newspaper in March 1807 reported, after a low spring tide and sand shifting, very unusually, that parts of a wreck in a very decayed state had been exposed out in the bay near Worm's Head. Local men gathered up large numbers of coins, one enterprisingly turning his trousers into a bag to carry them. The report said 12 pounds of silver dollars and half dollars had been dug out of the sand, equal to about 200 silver coins, as well as assorted bits of old iron and pewter. And they conjectured in the newspaper that it was part of a cargo of a rich Spanish vessel from South America. So when we were putting the book together, I kept saying to Edward Beslian, the numismatist, Edward, you know, we'd like to put this in, but you must, in your time of office in the museum, have seen one of these coins. Someone must have brought one in. Because they were also reported in the 1830s being found, along with musket balls, a marine astrolabe, two cannon were recovered and put in front of a house at Hill End, and so on. But then the sands came in and covered up all that evidence. So Edward said, no, I'm afraid, you know, we've never seen any of these coins, even though they're reported historically in the newspapers. And now, with digital newspapers, you can access all these reports quite quickly. And then, about 4 or 5 years ago, we received a phone call from the receiver of wreck saying that some coins had been found on the beach. So we cheered and said, well, perhaps it is from this wreck. It was 2016, and Edward looked at the coins. They were all 4 8-real pieces, New World Mint of Mexico and Potosi, majority from the reign of Philip IV, who reigned from 1621 to 1665. There were 2 Seville minted coins amongst them, so even if most of them are New Mexico and whatever, there's clearly a bit of a mix of Iberian in there that might have belonged to the crew as part of their personal savings. But it certainly looks as if this cargo was carrying Spanish government bullion. So then what's the context of that? We know from the Anne Francis that the bullion dates stop in the 1550s and the ship is lost in the 1580s. So there's almost a generation gap with those coins sitting in chests before they're actually put back in circulation on the ship for payment. They're in the bank vault, essentially, somewhere. So have we got the same situation here? We don't know the name of the ship. We are quite keen that we've acquired the coins now. Only found in 2 batteries. We've only just acquired the 2nd batch. And we're quite keen to establish whether the last date we've spotted so far is the 1630s. But when we've cleaned some of the coins that need cleaning, that may change. Then we've got to decide whether we're looking at a shipwreck lost in the 1540s, let's say, Civil War period, or are we looking at something a bit later, 1660s? Now, traditionally, Charles II's wife-to-be, Catherine of Braganza, came with a big dowry. Now, there was always a bit of a legend that perhaps this legendary loss was related to her dowry coming over, because it never arrived. But we don't still have a documentary sort of name of ship or anything. So perhaps it was coming incognito, you know, secreted somewhere. We just don't know. There are lots of stories we can weave at the moment. And so what we need to do is forensically explore all the evidence and clean the coins up. And should any other finds come to light on the beach, that might help us. The one thing that I'm hoping to do is to go and look at the one surviving gun. Because if that gun is Iberian, that gives us a clue. But I suspect that it might be of an English type. And we'll get some expertise to guide us on that. So that may help us out. So here are some of the coins. And this is Pirates of the Caribbean country, I must say. This is precisely the sort of coin that features in the film, or the series of films. Plotting coins, though, on beaches is one thing. Plotting shipwrecks is not new. This is this wonderful manuscript map of Georgian shipwrecks, drawn in 1807 by Captain Hugh Evans, harbour master at Holyhead. And he drew this up specifically to strengthen a campaign for creating a lighthouse on South Stack. But look at the detail in that. Each ship is a distinctive type. And you really get a sense, this is just losses in a year around Anglesey. You get a sense for the drama of what is happening and the hazards experienced by people. I'm going to turn now to a little known site, probably one of the most remote archaeological sites in Wales, on the Smalls Reef. So it's a series of rocks just on the south side of St George's Channel, astride one of the main historic routes between Ireland and the south of Wales. It's actually about 7 nautical miles west of the uninhabited island of Grasholm, with its Scandinavian name, place name. And this is more detail about Grasholm. Stockholm. So you're about 20 miles due west of Milton Haven. And in the 1990s, early 90s, we were contacted by the British Museum because a member of the Milton Keynes Tobacco Club had been diving on the Smalls as part of a leisure dive. And in trying to pick up what she thought was a lobster beneath an iron plate, one of the many bits of wreckage in the area, she picked up this object. It wasn't a blue lobster, it was a blue object. And it was blue because it was a finely decorated sword guard of Hiberno-Norse type, which had been trapped upside down beneath the wreck of the SS Ruabon, a cargo steamer built in 1818 and lost in a 4-6 storm in 1884 on the storms. On the Smalls, just on the south side of the lighthouse. So if you look at the image here, this is the Whiteside Lighthouse, the 18th century one was there. This is the 19th century lighthouse. And you can see the lighthouse is there. The material we were interested in looking at came from roughly that area there. That's roughly where they were diving. But you can see how stormy it could be. So it was quite a challenge to get out of there. But it is an absolutely stunning object, decorated in a style and technique of Irish fine metalwork, but of Hiberno-Norse type. The style is in origin Scandinavian, known as Ernest, the last Viking art style that's been recognised. Named after an eponymous church in western Norway that was built in around 1740. Bits of its timber were preserved in the mid-12th century reconstruction of the church. This style of decorating was adapted by metalworkers in Ireland to a range of objects And so we end up with a style which is called Irish Ernest, or more recently, Hiberno Ernest in style, with fields of ornament picked out with silver wire. The cross section in the background is a ground to hold niello, if you like. And niello is, in our case, it's silver sulfide, which gives you almost a black, glossy, enamel-like finish once that's in there. This, we were very keen, as part of writing this up, to try and work out how that niello was applied. And the wonderful master bladesmith, Frank Craddock, was commissioned to make a replica of the sword guard with it as it would originally have looked, but also make a suitable blade for us as well. Haven't got time to go into all of that, but essentially the big challenge for him was working how the niello was applied, because no one in Britain could tell him, because you're trying to apply niello hot to a three-dimensional object, and what you can't have it doing is just falling off the object over the fire. He eventually found a family, an Indian family in Birmingham, who the grandfather or the father had worked in the 1930s in India as a silversmith, and could describe a system of spit roasting the metal object over a heat source, so that the niello is sort of constantly revolving with the object until you've covered everything. But this is the finished product. He's done a remarkably good job in recreating it, and we've learnt a lot in the process. The object itself probably dates to somewhere between 1100 and 1125, depending on which evidence you look at. There's a suggestion that it might actually be towards the beginning of that date. But to give you a sense of the context of why a sword like that, which is high status, it's of diplomatic quality, why is it doing on the small? What was it doing being found on smalls? I don't think it was part of an antiquarian collection on board a cargo steamer. That doesn't make any sense. And equally, you wouldn't have a valuable sword like that in a position where you might drop it overboard. That just would not happen. You would carefully wrap a sword like that, which would be extremely valuable, in a watertight leather bag and put it in a chest, tie the chest down. The implication is that we have a shipwreck of the early 12th century, and that the sword is all we have left to indicate that that happened. But we know that in the 1050s, a Viking fleet was lost off the Hebarth. We don't have any more details than that from Welsh annals. To give you an idea of the context in which a diplomatic object like that, a high status elite gift, if you like, might have been travelling between Wales and Ireland, we don't know which direction. But at that time, Munster was dominated by Irish King Murchatach Ua Briain, who died in 1119. The Britta to Asogion and Ben Heneth the Saison tell us that Arnulf de Montgomery, Earl of Pembroke, sent his steward, or seneschal, Gerald of Windsor to Ireland to arrange military assistance from King Murchatach at that time, around 1102. And this alliance was formalised by marriage between Arnulf and one of the king's daughters, Lafrecoth. And according to the Welsh Brit, Arnulf thought to make peace with the Irish and to obtain help from them. And he sent messengers to Ireland, that is Gerald the Steward and many others, to ask for the daughter of King Murchatach, or Murtart, for his wife. And thus he easily obtained, and the messengers came joyfully to their land, and Murchatach, Murtart, in the Welsh version, sent his daughter and many armed ships along with her to his aid. And when the earls had exalted themselves with pride because of those events, they refused to accept any peace from the king. In the meantime, Arnulf and his men had gone to meet his wife, and the armed fleet was coming to his aid. So you can imagine lots of toing and froing, ships, fleets, so on. Lots of travel. We know that's happening anyway for various purposes, as movements of people and for goods and commerce and so on. But you do wonder whether, you know, I don't think we're going to get any closer than that. All we can say that that's context of comings and goings between Wales and South Wales and Ireland is the context in which an object like that, a prized object, was lost. So it's a, you know, one of the many stories, plausible contexts we can develop. Oh, sorry, that was Joe. That was, of course, the. If we go. I don't know where we go back. Can we go back? This is Matthew Paris. I just calculated it's after the Battle of Bouvines, so it's not strictly relevant. But I think it's just nice to see the swords falling out of a shipwreck there. And it's slightly later in the day, but it gives you a sense of what could be going on. Sometimes the objects you find are self-explanatory, and this was some work on the marine and coastal environment funded by CADU in the 1990s for the Welsh Archaeological Trusts. And they undertook rapid survey of the coast of Wales, and the project was called Arfordir. Enormous task requiring walking the 1,500 kilometre long coastline, and they recorded over 3,000 archaeological sites in process, and this is just one bit of shipwreck being uncovered. More recently, of course, you may be aware of the Royal Commission's work in Anglesey on the compilation of the all-important maritime record for newly appointed specialist maritime archaeologist on the staff for many years now. That post is continuing in various ways, researching, recording, surveying and exploring the water heritage in Wales in a way that I think we've been unable to. The key thing is that everything has been mapped onto the mapping system that the Royal Commission use, and it's terribly useful when wind farms are being developed, or at least conceptualised, so the archaeological implications for barrages and off-sea industry, including mineral extraction, can be evaluated. But some of that work by the Commission also includes recording crashed aircraft sites now, which were previously excluded back in the 60s and 70s. And here we've got some work on recording First World War wrecks. This is the Apapa. And the, as part of the commemorating the First World War programme, the Royal Commission and several partners were involved in looking at wartime losses in Welsh waters. So this is a loss off the Anglesey coast. And this is a multi-beam sonar sub-bottom profiler type image. I think it's of what's left of that wreck. So, and some of these you can actually start to visualise in three dimensions, depending on the system of recording that you've got. Many of you may know of the Resurgam, described as one of the world's first practical submarines. Depends how you define practical. And certainly one of the oldest powered submarines. It was designed by the eccentric Reverend George Garrett, who went on to invent torpedoes for the government. And it was built in 1879 by Cochrane & Company and launched at Birkenhead in 1879. I think that is Reverend Garrett. He's doing a Michael Jackson, holding his infant rather precariously on the conning tower. So basically, it was launched at Birkenhead, and then they had to sail it around the Welsh coast to take it to Portsmouth to demonstrate its capabilities to the Royal Navy. It reached Rhyl, didn't get much further. And that's partly because there was a storm, and she was being towed by a paddle steamer, the Elfin, and it was pretty rough. And you know, there's some question about whether it was an intentional loss because they had doubts about its capabilities when it got to Portsmouth. Right? Well, we just don't know. I find fascinating is that before I came to Wales, I was part of a volunteer group doing underwater survey. And a lot of our work was in the Thames estuary, on the Goodwood Sands and so on. But we did get a request to try and find the Resurgam. And so we went up to Rhyl back in about 1987. And we tried sub-bottom profiling and I remember climbing up, putting in trisponders around the coast, on precarious high points on the North Welsh coast, to tell you where you were on the boat. And then you use those to track pop the boat's position and record what you're recording. Unfortunately, it's very bad weather prevented us completing the survey. But we were really pleased when we heard that a fish in 1995, the resurgam had been discovered, not far away from where we'd been looking. But so using sub-bottom profilers and side-scan sonar, the fisherman has snagged his nets on that. So it's net snaggings are another important source of information, but another method of discovery. So this is the resurgam. This is her. So subsequently, the archaeological diving units and various other marine archaeologists were asked to record her. And interestingly, you can see that her position has rotated. She's actually just sitting a bit like a tin can on the seabed. And somewhat exposed to inclement weather, I must say. One of the issues is, of course, is she better off? The debate is it better to leave her where she is? She's reached some sort of equilibrium in terms of her metal hull, her iron hull, and the steam engine inside. Or is it better to try and lift her and then conserve her? That's a debate that continues. I think we'll all be sad if something happens. But at the moment, the cost of satisfactory and successfully conserving a submarine like this is a real challenge and fraught with problems. So I mentioned the U-boat project. The Royal Commission has come to an end now. This is what they were set up to deliver. Very exciting working with communities. This is the H5. British H-class submarine built by Canadian Vickers at Montreal and launched in 1915 for the Royal Navy and to serve in the First World War. On the 26th of February 1918, she sailed from Bearhaven to patrol a line 10 miles east of Carnarvon Bay, and she was due to return on 2nd of March, but on that very day she was tragically mistaken for a German U-boat by a British merchantman called Ruffer Glenn, who rammed her and sunk. All 26 mariners lost their lives, including a United States Lieutenant, W.F. Childs, who was an observer and the first member of the U.S. Navy to die in the First World War. Very interesting story. And that is the remains of that ship on the seabed now. And this is part of the National Monuments Record, the maritime record that the Royal Commission curates. So, important question, where are we now? We've made incremental progression. In terms of maritime archaeology, it is under-resourced, of course, but there are glimmers of progress. And I haven't mentioned the Newport ship intentionally, because it's really the subject of another lecture, and I thoroughly recommend it. There are so many strands to that story. I've studied the pottery from the wreck, so we know that the Newport ship material comes from Iberia, that the wreck itself, the ship itself, was built in the 1460s. The environmental samples have only just been looked at. They are provenancing some of the activities in the Iberian Peninsula as well. The pottery is probably made in the Lisbon area, but we don't know exactly where. There are Portuguese coins on board. The ceramics were part of the crew's possessions because they're sooted. We know that it was armed because we've got the mixed shot and mixed bore. There was a leather bracer from a longbowman on board, as well as a fragmented helmet. And it's feeding into that really interesting period, 1460s, late 1460s, with what is going on between the Herberts and the Earl of Warwick and the Wars of the Roses. There has been a recent publication by the University of Arts Press from historians largely based at Bristol University that is focusing on different aspects of the history behind the context of the Newport ship. And again, I thoroughly recommend you have a look at it. It's really the subject of another lecture. The wreck of the Ottawa, 1860, real. The good thing is that this is now protected as an integral part of any harbour development projects. So, and that's at low tide. Really good news that it's now actively being managed as a historic site. One of the challenges, of course, is capturing what we ourselves remember. Because, you know, if you think back, we collectively have, you know, a span of collective memory amongst us. And so oral traditions are well worth considering in the heritage that we endeavour to save for future generations. Some of the questions that we might have remain. What's the future of the Resurgam, for example? It's still exposed. It's still undergoing corrosion, even though it has sacrificial anodes to slow down corrosion. It's still buffeted in tempestuous seas off the coast of Rome. Will all the finds from the Anne Frances that have recently been made end up in a museum collection held on behalf of the people of Wales? Will financial constraints jeopardise implementation of the best mitigation strategies to the ever-growing requirements for energy and aggregates, wind farms, and so on? What happens when, and it can only be a matter of time, a medieval cog is discovered through dredging or another method, not being tripped over, I must say, in Welsh waters? How will we respond to such a discovery? Those challenges are still there. I'll go back and just show you. I'm going to finish with these images. Frances Place, we mustn't forget the visual record, there hasn't been time to cover that. So he was in Wales in 1678. He was on a fishing expedition, but he was sketching and scenes from life around the coast, pencil sketches of shipping and maritime features that have long disappeared. These are an important record. So you may recognise Cardiff with the castle, the medieval quay. This is Quay Street. This is the line of Quay Street, of course. There you've got a ship, and there you've got the quay itself here. There's St John's. So, yes, really important sort of post-Civil War record of Cardiff. There are several views like that. What was interesting was that he was going around with a fellow artist, William Lodge, at the time. And they were arrested during this excursion as suspected Jesuit spies because of anti-Catholic feeling at the time and the Popish plot to assassinate James II. So it was a problem for artists who had non-local accents and were drawing coastal town defences and castles and quays. I think arrest is an occupational hazard for those people. And I'll just mention the Reverend Calvin Richard Jones, well known for his photography, but he was an astonishing artist as well. He had many finished works, which are coastal and maritime. He was an acute observer of ships, an accurate observer of ships. And these are just from one of his sketchbooks. This isn't a finished piece of work. But he gives you a sense of Swansea Bay, when you could have stood on the shoreline of Swansea Bay, you would have seen the sea peppered with the sails of ships, much like this. We feature another sketchbook in the book. But interestingly, he became a leading exponent of the fledgling art of photography in the 1840s and 50s. And you can see how both his art and his interest in photography merged together. When I showed the sketchbooks to David Jenkins, who's retired from National Waterfront Museum as a curator, one of the leading authorities you know on 19th century shipping, he said, wow, you know, he's really got that rigging right, spot on, you know. So he was an astonishingly accurate observer of seaborne transport. Many of you may have heard of the Franklin Expedition, but how many of you realise that HMS Erebus, Franklin's ship, was actually built and launched in Pembroke Dock. This is an Admiralty model. It's actually showing a conversion, strengthening of the hull so that she can be sent for polar exploration. In 1839 or thereabouts, she was sent off to the Antarctic under James Ross. She was a Hecla class bomb vessel built in Pembroke Dock. After 2 years' service, she was selected along with the Terror for an Antarctic expedition under Ross, which was terribly important. And then she went was sent off under the Franklin expedition of 1845. And remarkably, not that long ago, in 2014, her hull was discovered off King William Island in Canada. And there you see the hull standing upright on the bottom of the seabed. It's a side scan sonar image. So this is a sonar, it's not an aerial photograph, but you can almost see how that works. So this is a sonic shadow, and this is the line of the fish you tow behind the boat. So it sends out a beam that way, and it gets acoustic rebounds back, which it records. This is that's the left-hand side, that's the right-hand side. So, and of course, the Terror has been found as well. So these are remarkable things. There was an exhibition at the National Maritime Museum about 3 or 4 years ago featuring some of these things. The Franklin expedition was one of those great Victorian tragedies, countless explorers trying to work out by going to Antarctica to find the remains of the expedition. And of course, you will know that the remains that were found included evidence for cannibalism for those that survived for a short period. But a very interesting story. And I'm just going to conclude with some contrasting images. New evidence turns up in unexpected places. In 2002, we have this remarkable graffiti inside an outside toilet in Treveen in Pembrokeshire, which was recorded by David Jenkins and others. And so penciled into the lime wash wall, you see these rough sketches of vessels, actually very good, both sail and steam. And the person incumbent in the toilet was clearly intent on recording the ships that visited the nearby harbour at Porthgain, sort of granite chippings in the late 20s and 30s. And he not only drew the ships, he recorded their gross tonnage, the nature, weight of the cargo loaded to destination. So, remarkable sort of manuscript form of record. I haven't mentioned the Royal Charter, again, that's almost another lecture. Lost in 1859, these are some of the losses in the 1859 gale. The Royal Charter continues to provide a powerful lesson from the past, and one in which those stories have been told through museums these days, where we endeavour to use collections and create an welcoming environment to inspire visitors with some of these stories. National Waterfront Museum is a good example, but you will find some of the stories in this book, which I think is remarkable value in terms of ounces per sterling pound that you get. You need a strong bag to take it home if you are buying one. But if you do want to dive deeper and explore further, consider having a look at this book. On behalf of my co-editors, and all the numerous contributors in the Royal Commission, Dieltenbauer.